You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of the Bamford translation of Steiner's classic book, How to Know Higher Worlds, A Modern Path of Initiation. This is Chapter 3, entitled Initiation. Paragraph 1. Initiation is the highest level of esoteric training about which generally intelligible written indications may still be given. Whatever lies beyond initiation is difficult to communicate in an understandable way. Yet the path to this knowledge is open to all who have worked their way through the stages of preparation, illumination, and initiation, and reached the lower mysteries. Paragraph 2. Initiation bestows upon us knowledge and abilities we would otherwise acquire in a different way, and form only in the distant future, after many incarnations. A person initiated today experiences in this life something that he or she would normally experience only later, and under quite different circumstances. Paragraph 3. We can fully experience only as much of the mysteries of existence as the level of our maturity allows. This is the only reason why we find obstacles on our path to higher knowledge and capacities. One should not use a firearm until one has had enough experience to use it without causing damage. If we were initiated today without preparation, we would lack the experiences we would otherwise continue to gather through future incarnations up to the moment when, as part of the normal course of our development, these mysteries were revealed to us. As we arrive at the doorway to initiation, these experiences must be replaced by something else. Therefore, the first instructions given to candidates for initiation form a substitute for future experiences they would have had in lives to come. These instructions concern the so-called, in quotes, trials through which a candidate must pass. The trials themselves arise as the natural consequence of our soul life, when the exercises described in the previous chapters have been practiced in the right way. Paragraph 4. Such trials, of course, are often mentioned in books, but by their very nature, such descriptions generally give a false impression. For a person who has not passed through the stages of preparation and illumination has never experienced these trials, and therefore cannot correctly describe them. Paragraph 5. Certain things and facts belonging to the higher worlds necessarily arise for candidates for initiation. But we shall only see and hear these if we are sensitive to the spiritual perception of shapes, colors, sounds, and so forth, described in the chapters on preparation and illumination. Paragraph 6. The first trial consists in achieving a truer perception than the average person possesses of the physical properties, initially of inanimate bodies, and then of plants, animals, and human beings. This has nothing to do with what is called scientific knowledge. We are not concerned here with science, but with perception. As a rule, the procedure is one in which, as candidates for initiation, we learn to recognize how natural things and living beings reveal themselves to our spiritual ears and eyes. In a certain sense, these things stand before us unveiled or naked. The qualities that we come to see and hear were veiled from our physical sight and hearing. The fact that during initiation this veil falls away is due to a process called, quote, the process of spiritual burning away, close quote. For this reason, the first trial is called the fire trial. Paragraph 7. For many people, ordinary life itself is already a more or less unconscious process of initiation through the fire trial. Such people have lived a life so rich in experiences that their self-confidence, courage, and steadfastness have matured in healthy ways. They have learned to bear suffering, disappointment, and failure calmly, magnanimously, and with unbroken strength. People who have worked through their experiences in this way are often already, although without knowing it clearly, initiates. It then takes only a little to open their spiritual eyes so that they become seers. One thing is certain. The purpose of the real fire trial is not to satisfy our curiosity. To be sure, we shall come to know extraordinary facts that other people have no inkling of. But acquaintance with such facts is not the objective. It is but the means to an end. The objective is to acquire truer self-confidence, greater courage, and quite a different kind of magnanimity and endurance than is normally attainable within the lower world. Paragraph 8. Candidates may still turn back after the fire trial. They may return to ordinary life, strengthened in body and soul, and continue their initiation in a future incarnation. If we decide to do this, we become more useful members of society and humanity in our present incarnation than we were before. Whatever our situation may be, our inner strength, mindfulness, and positive effect on other people will have increased. Paragraph 9. If, having completed the fire trial, we decide to continue the path of initiation, then a particular system of writing, customarily used in occult training, is unveiled to us. The characters of this script reveal the actual secret teachings. For what is really, in quotes, hidden, or occult, in things, is not directly expressible in the words of ordinary language, nor recordable in any ordinary system of writing. Rather, those who have learned from initiates translate the teachings of esoteric science into ordinary language as best they can. This occult script is inscribed forever in the spiritual world. Once the soul has attained spiritual perception, the script is revealed to it. But we do not learn to read this occult alphabet in the same way that we learn to read an ordinary human alphabet. Rather, it is as if we grow toward clairvoyant knowing, and while we grow, there develops in us, as a soul faculty, a force impelling us to decipher, as if they were the characters of a script, the events and beings of the spiritual world present before us. As our inner development unfolds, it can happen that this power and the experience of the trial connected with it appear on their own. However, we shall be more likely to reach our goal if we follow the instructions of experienced esoteric researchers who are proficient in deciphering the hidden script. Paragraph 10. The signs of this occult writing are not arbitrarily devised, but correspond to the forces at work in the world. Through these signs, we learn the language of things. As candidates for initiation, we realize immediately that these signs correspond to the figures, colors, and sounds that we learned to perceive in the earlier stages of preparation and illumination. It becomes apparent that all that came before was like learning the letters of the alphabet in order to spell, but now we begin to read in the higher world. All that previously appeared only in isolated figures, sounds, and colors now appears as one great connected and interrelated whole. For the first time, we experience complete certainty in our observation of the higher worlds. Before, we could never be sure whether the things we saw were seen correctly. At this point, for the first time, regular communication is possible between candidates and initiates concerning the realms of higher knowledge. For however closely an initiate may live together with other people in everyday life, he or she can communicate higher knowledge directly only in the sign language mentioned above. Paragraph 11. Through this language, we are introduced to certain rules for the conduct of life. We learn of duties we knew nothing about before. Knowing these rules of conduct, we become able to perform actions with a significance that the actions of uninitiated people could never have. We act out of the higher worlds. The directives for such actions can be received only in the occult script. Paragraph 12. It should be emphasized that there are people who perform such actions unconsciously, without having undergone an esoteric training. These, quote, helpers of the world and humanity, close quote, pass through life bestowing blessings and good deeds wherever they go. For reasons that will not be discussed here, they have been endowed with gifts that seem supernatural. They differ from those following the path to higher knowledge only in that the latter act consciously, understanding the larger context of their actions. What we as occult students achieve through training and esoteric practice, the higher powers bestow on these blessed people for the benefit of the whole world. We should revere those so favored by God, but we should not therefore consider the work of esoteric training superfluous. Paragraph 13. After we've learned to read the occult sign writing, another trial begins. In this trial, we must demonstrate that we can move freely and surely in the higher worlds. In ordinary life, impulses from the external world prompt our actions. We work at this or that job because our situation imposes certain duties upon us. Needless to say, we must not neglect any of our duties because we are living in the higher worlds. No higher duty should force us to neglect even one of our duties in the ordinary world. If we are parents, we shall continue to fulfill our responsibilities just as well as we did before entering upon the path to higher knowledge. Whatever our job may be, whether government, official, or soldier, following the path to higher knowledge should not keep us from doing our job. On the contrary, esoteric training enhances, to a degree inconceivable to the uninitiated, the very qualities that make us competent in life. If this does not always seem to be the case, it is because those who have not been initiated do not know how to judge those who have been. The actions of the initiated are not always readily comprehensible to others, but, as has been said, this applies in just a few cases. Paragraph 14. We have now reached a level of initiation where we have duties to perform, but no outward reason to do so. We are moved to carry them out not by external circumstances, but only by the standards revealed to us in the hidden language of the secret script. In this second trial, we must demonstrate that we can act according to these standards as surely and steadily as good secretaries carry out the duties that devolve upon them. To this end, we shall feel ourselves faced in the course of our training with a particular task. We must act on the basis of perceptions made as a result of what we learned during preparation and illumination. We must discover what we are to do by reading the occult writing that we have now made our own. If we can recognize our duty and carry it out correctly, then we have successfully passed this trial. We can tell whether we have succeeded in carrying out a duty from the changes in the figures, colors, and sounds we perceive with our spiritual ears and eyes. The instructions for esoteric training describe exactly what these figures and so on are supposed to look like after our action and how we are to perceive them. As candidates for initiation, we must learn how to produce such changes in our spiritual perceptions. This trial is called the water trial, because when we act in these higher realms, outer circumstances no longer support us, in quotes, just as we lose the ground under our feet when we swim in deep water. This practice should be repeated until we have complete confidence in our abilities. Paragraph 15. As in the fire trial, the water trial has to do with acquiring a certain quality or virtue that would normally take many incarnations to develop. But as a result of our experiences in the higher world, we are able to develop this quality in a short time and to an advanced degree. The point is this. In order to produce these changes in the higher realms, we must learn to act wholly according to our spiritual perceptions and our reading of the sacred script. If we let any personal wishes, opinions, and so forth enter this activity, if we fail even for a moment to comply with the laws we know are right, and follow instead our own whims, then something quite different will happen than was intended. Our activity would immediately lose its bearings, its objective, and confusion would intrude. This trial provides us with abundant opportunities for the development of self-control, which is of prime importance. The trial will thus be easier for those who have acquired self-control in their lives before initiation. Those who can follow high principles and ideals, regardless of personal feelings and desires, who understand the need to perform duties even when inclinations and sympathies turn them in another direction, are already, and without knowing it, initiates in ordinary life. For such people, passing this second trial will be an easy matter. Indeed, it must be said that as a rule, one must already have achieved a certain, albeit unconscious, degree of initiation to pass this trial. For just as it is difficult to learn to write as an adult when one has not learned to do so as a child, so it is difficult to develop the self-control necessary at the moment of insight into higher worlds if one has not already achieved a certain amount of self-control in everyday life. Our wishes, desires, and inclinations do not change the realities of the physical world, but they have a real effect on things in the higher worlds. To produce a particular effect in the higher worlds, therefore, we must have complete power over ourselves. We must be able to follow the right discipline and not be subject to our own arbitrariness. Paragraph 16. An important human quality that enters into consideration above all else at this stage of initiation is an unconditionally sound, reliable power of judgment. This faculty needs to be trained through all the earlier stages. Whether this has been done or not shows whether we are fit for the true path of knowledge. For to continue on this path, we must now be able to distinguish true reality from illusion, insubstantial figments of the imagination, superstition, and all manner of delusion. Making this distinction is to begin with more difficult on these higher planes of existence than on the lower ones. All preconceptions and cherished beliefs must disappear. Truth alone must be the guiding principle. We have to be perfectly prepared to let go of any thought, opinion, or inclination if logical thinking demands it. Certainty in the higher worlds cannot be attained if one is in any way attached to one's own opinions. Paragraph 17. Progress on the esoteric path is impossible if our way of thinking tends toward fantasy and superstition. We are on the verge of gaining a precious gift. We are about to lose all doubts concerning the higher worlds. They are to be revealed before our spiritual eyes in all their lawfulness. But we cannot receive this treasure as long as we allow ourselves to be deceived by illusion and delusion. It would be fatal if we allowed fantasy and prejudices to run away with our reason. Indeed, dreamers and fantasists are as little fitted for the occult path as are those who are superstitious. The worst enemies on the path of higher cognition are dreaming, fantasizing, and superstition. These enemies cannot be taken too seriously. Nevertheless, we must always remember that although, quote, all prejudices must fall from you, close quote, is inscribed over the door leading to the second trial, and, quote, without healthy human understanding, all steps are in vain, close quote, stands at the entrance to the first. This by no means implies that esoteric students lose the poetry of life and the capacity for enthusiasm. Paragraph 18. Once we have matured sufficiently along these lines, a third trial awaits us. This trial is without any tangible distinct goal. Everything is up to us. We find ourselves in a situation where nothing moves us to act. We must each find our own way, by ourselves and out of ourselves. There are no things or people who might help us to act. Nothing and nobody can give us the strength we need except we ourselves. If we do not find this strength within ourselves, we will soon be back where we were before. It must be said, however, that such failures are rare. Having passed the previous trials, we are likely to find the strength. A person who has not turned back before will generally succeed this time too. Here, what matters is the ability to collect oneself promptly and act decisively. For now, in the true sense of the word, we must discover the, in quotes, higher self. We must resolve at every moment to listen to the inspiration of the Spirit in all things. There is no longer time for scruples, doubts, and so on. Each moment of hesitation only proves that we are not yet ready. We must courageously overcome all that keeps us from listening to the Spirit. What matters is that we show presence of mind under these circumstances. This is the quality or attribute to be cultivated during this stage of development. For this purpose, all our habitual enticements to act, and even to think, now disappear. To avoid falling into passivity, therefore, our task is not to lose ourselves. Only within ourselves will we find a fixed point to hold on to. No one who reads these lines without knowing anything about what they refer to should feel any antipathy for this condition of being thrown back upon oneself. On the contrary, to pass this trial means the highest bliss. Paragraph 19. Everyday life can serve as an esoteric school for spiritual presence of mind, just as it does for the other qualities required for initiation. This is particularly true in the case of those who, suddenly confronted with life tasks or problems, have learned to act rapidly and decisively without hesitation or reflection. We learn this ability, above all, in situations whose successful outcome depends upon speedy action. For example, if we can act quickly when a misfortune threatens, one that could not be averted if we hesitated even for a moment. And if we can make such decisiveness a permanent quality, we have already unconsciously prepared ourselves for the third trial. This trial is intended to develop absolute presence of mind. In schools for esoteric training, this trial is called the air trial. Here we can rely neither on the solid ground of outer motivation, nor on insights gained from the shapes, colors, and so on we came to know in the stages of preparation and illumination. Instead, we must now rely completely upon ourselves. Paragraph 20. Once we have passed this trial, we may enter the temple of higher cognition, wisdom. Of this little more remains to be said. Only the barest indications may be given. The task to be accomplished now is often described as having to swear an oath never to, in quotes, betray the secret teachings. However, the terms oath and betray are inaccurate and even misleading. There is no question here of an oath in the ordinary sense of the word. Rather, it is a matter of experience. We learn how to apply the secret teachings, how to place them at the service of humanity. Only now do we begin to understand the world properly. What is important is not to conceal and withhold the higher truths, but to learn to present them tactfully, appropriately, and in the right way. What we learn to, in quotes, keep silent about is something quite different. We now acquire the noble quality of silence with regard to many things that we used to talk about before, and especially with regard to how we used to talk about them. We would be poor initiates if we did not place the mysteries we have experienced at the service of the world as much as possible. The only obstacle to communication in this area is the failure of others to understand what we say. Naturally, the higher mysteries are not suited to aimless talk and chatter. But this is not to forbid a person who has reached this stage of development to speak. No one, neither a human nor any other kind of being, will ever impose such an, in quotes, oath upon us. We alone are responsible. We must learn to discover within ourselves what is to be done in every situation. The oath means nothing more than that we are ready to bear such a responsibility. Paragraph 21. When we are sufficiently matured for these experiences, we receive what is called symbolically the, quote, potion of oblivion, close quote. That is, we are initiated into the secret of action uninterrupted by the lower memory. This is necessary for an initiate, who must always have complete confidence in the immediate present. We must know how to tear down the veils of memory that surround us at every moment of our lives. Otherwise, if I judge today's experiences by those of yesterday, I become subject to many errors. This does not mean that we should deny our prior experiences. On the contrary, as far as possible, they should always be present. But initiates have to be able to judge each new experience on its own merits and let it work upon them, untroubled by the past. In other words, I must always be ready to receive a new revelation from each and every being and thing. To judge the new on the basis of the old only leads to errors. Yet the memory of past experiences is useful, precisely because it enables one to see new ones. That is, without a given past experience, I might never see the characteristic feature of the things or beings I encounter. Past experiences should help us to see what is new, not to judge it. As initiates, we develop quite specific faculties for this. Thereby many things reveal themselves that remain hidden from the uninitiated. Paragraph 22. The second potion given to initiates is the, quote, potion of memory, close quote. This enables one to keep the higher mysteries always present and in mind. Our ordinary memory is insufficient for this. We must become completely one with the higher mysteries. Merely knowing them is not enough. They must become as much a matter of course to us in our daily actions as eating and drinking are to ordinary people. They must become practice, habit, disposition, so that we do not need to think about them in the ordinary sense. They should express themselves through us, flow through us, like the vital functions of our organism. In this way we grow spiritually closer to the level that nature has already brought us to physically. The end of chapter 3.